This is the People's Game. On today's show, we'll preview the USA's second-round match against Ghana. We'll be joined by Nick Green, a journalist who has followed the USA men's team throughout the past decade. Then, in the roundtable, Jennifer, Fernando, myself, Tony, and Pablo will discuss today's action and look forward to both of tomorrow's matches. Then we're joined by David Choi from Radio Korea in Los Angeles, who is going to explain the sea of red that will flood central Los Angeles for a public screening of the first second-round match tomorrow morning. Then we go all the way to the Ivory Coast and talk to John James about what the national football team has meant and means to the Ivory Coast and his thoughts about their exit from the tournament. And then our featured interview of the show with Jenna Pell of the blog All White Kit. Jennifer Doyle will speak with Jenna about the WPS, the Women's Professional Soccer League here in the United States. And we'll wrap the show up with our call for global football revolution. All that and more on The People's Game. This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky.
I'm Jennifer Doyle.
I'm Fernando Romero.
And we're joined on the phone by Nick Green. Welcome to The People's Game, Nick.
Good to be here.
Nick Green is, of course, a writer with the Daily Breeze. He has a fantastic blog called 100% Soccer, and he is, in my estimation, the sports journalist who follows the USA men's team as close as any in the country or any in the world. And tomorrow is, once again, the biggest match in the history of the U.S. men's soccer team. keeps happening that way.
You never get tired of saying that, do you?
No. Well, it's certainly the case this time around again. They have a very quick turnaround. That's definitely part of the subtext of this game tomorrow. The USA and Ghana are two of the sides that in the second round only got 2 days off before they play. They both are suffering that equally, just 2 days between games. And what do you expect to see from Team USA approaching Ghana, both given who Ghana is and the fact that there's only 2 days rest?
Well, let me answer that by talking about Ghana. If you had told me before this tournament started that Ghana would be the lone African team in the round of 16 for the second successive World Cup, I can't imagine what kind of odds you would have got on that. And to do it without Chelsea midfielder Michael Essien makes it even more remarkable, because they're a very young team, and a lot of their players are quite unknown. They're also sort of the ultimate tournament meh team. I mean, they beat Serbia 1-0. They drew with Australia, the weakest team in the group, 1-1. And then they lost to Germany, 1-0. And both their goals came from penalties.
Right.
And they were both scored by the same guy. So, Guyan. And so he's the main attacking threat, but they're not really an incredibly attack-minded side that I think, apart from Guyan's speed, which always is a worry in the sort of immobile U.S. defense we're used to, they're not an overtly attacking team that are going to come at you from all sides. So I don't expect to see a very different U.S. team lining up in this game than we saw in the last game. I would not be at all surprised that Bob Bradley stuck with Maurice Adu from Fontana in the midfield, who had a very good calming effect in the last game. I'm going to sound like a broken record, and I'm going to say that keep saying this, but I want to see Edson Buddle start a game. We still haven't seen that. Hercules Gomez is not a starter for my money. He's excellent coming off the bench, as he proved in Mexico. But I guess the big question is whether we're going to see Onwuayi, Gooch back, who was dropped for the last game. I suspect not. I don't think Bob will want to mess with a winning formula if I know conservative Mr. Bradley. So it's going to be kind of a curious game. I mean, we still don't really know that much about Ghana even after 3 games of this World Cup, don't you think?
Do you have a sense of why Gooch was benched and where he went? What happened?
Yeah, I haven't really seen a good explanation on that. I'm guessing that Bradley just saw his limitations coming back from that injury, saw that perhaps he wasn't as sharp as he could be, saw that he wasn't completely match fit, and decided to just sit him for now.
You know, every week in club soccer for every team around the world, there's expectations when they're at home and there are expectations when they're on the road. Okay, this was obviously something that the Group A teams had to contend with South Africa. Now that Ghana is the only African side remaining in the tournament, do you think there will be any kind of distinctive home field advantage that they will have?
Well, I was thinking about that earlier today, actually, especially since, you know, this program tries to come at the World Cup and sport from a socioeconomic, geopolitical standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they are the only African team left in the World Cup. You know that the South African supporters are going to be behind them. You know that the entire continent of Africa is going to be willing them on.
Mm.
I guess the question becomes, will that be enough, as the other African teams proved?
Right, that hasn't been considerable, but of course it is more focused. It'll be extremely focused. And I spoke earlier today with someone in the Ivory Coast, and they said that everybody now is grabbing up all the Ghana gear that they can find, getting ready to get fully behind Ghana's side. So Tim Howard, how's he looking? Is that injury seem healed to you?
Looks fine. Looks fine to me, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Tim Howard, I don't think, is going to be the weakest part of the U.S. lineup. And incidentally, the player who has impressed me, in addition to Guyan up front, has been their goalkeeper, Kingston.
From my favorite British Premiership side, Wigan Athletic. Well, let me ask you this before we let you go. What will it mean, in your mind, to U.S. soccer to reach the quarterfinals for the second time in three World Cups?
Well, I think you started this little segment by saying this game is the biggest in U.S. soccer history again, so I guess we're going to have to say that the effect will be the largest on U.S. soccer history again if they win. I mean, ratings are up 60% approximately for this World Cup over 4 years ago, and it was essentially the same time period. Lots and lots and lots more people are paying attention this time around.
That's really true.
Than they were 4 years ago. You know, you can't try and get through a day at work like a friend of mine that I just picked up at LAX tried to and got very annoyed about finding out the score. You can't do that this time. You can't do it. People are talking. As soon as I walk in the office, people are going, where do I go watch the game? Where's the place? I don't want to watch at home. I want to be around other people. I mean, there's an incredible buzz that you just don't hear about soccer.
Yeah.
I mean,
you posted a wonderful YouTube video that's been making the rounds that I believe was sent to the U.S. men's national side. It's a montage of people's basically video footage from their phones, I think, of the moment in bars when people saw Landon Donovan put that goal in the net. And just so it's just this little montage with some very patriotic music playing in the background, you know, showing, you know, bars in Nebraska, Montana, in Boston, in New York, and Davis, California, in, I can't remember if it was Los Angeles or San Diego, you know, people just losing their minds all over the country. And I was moved against my own sort of anti-nationalist impulses. But I was also touched that you included in your blog, 100% Soccer, a reference to I think this might have been a link might have been tweeted to guys on the national side, including Donovan, who said that they, you know, moved them to tears to see that it meant the world. I worry that this sense of the visibility of it would be rattling them. I think that's a really hard kind of burden to, you know, Bill Clinton knocking back beers with you in the locker room. I mean, that I wonder how good that is for the men's team. So I have a little bit of a mother hen sort of protective instinct sort of toward them, just like, oh, you know, I want them to stay focused and stay calm and centered. So it's going to be a big game.
Yeah, but it beats being ignored completely, doesn't it?
Sure does. And, you know, they have the rest of the sex of the female players of the world who can tell you all about how that feels.
Right. Exactly.
So,
I was going to say the sport's been in a vacuum for so long in this country.
Yeah.
It's good to finally see it sort of breaking out a bit into the general public, into the mainstream.
Yeah, it is.
Nick Green, 100% Soccer. We'll be trying to reach you tomorrow after the game to get your reflections here on The People's Game.
I will pay attention to my cell phone. Always good chatting with you. Take care. Enjoy the game tomorrow.
This is The People's Game, and this is our daily roundtable. I'm Alan Minsky.
I'm Jennifer Doyle.
I'm Fernando Romero.
And we're joined on the phone by
Tony Presedo.
Going into today's action, the big event that could have occurred was the possible elimination of one of the co-favorites for the tournament, Spain. And, of course, Tony is our resident expert on the Spanish side. Well, they averted that, but, again, not the brilliance, consistent brilliance throughout the match that people are still looking to Spain to sort of attain and sustain. Is that how you felt?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it was unconvincing. There were moments where they looked great, and there were moments where they didn't look great. And then the last 10 minutes of that game, I mean, hard to watch. Brings back memories of that Germany-Austria game where both people know the score and decide to end it the way it is, you know, because both of them had their passage guaranteed into the next round. So hard to watch. I'm hoping that this is sort of like a slow build into the game against Portugal. But Portugal, another really tough team defensively that's going to give them problems in terms of Spain will have a hard time breaking them down.
Yeah, no goals so far against Portugal.
Yeah.
I saw the exact same thing. He saw it towards the last couple of minutes of the game. I saw Spain that was just kicking the ball around like it was just, you know, just a soccer practice. And I saw Chile that it seemed that was just, you know, we're not even going to move. But one thing that struck me was the resilience by the Chilean team. They scored right out of the dressing room in the second half, and it showed a lot of the weaknesses in the defensive backline of Spain with that score, which, by the way, was a brilliant strike anyway. But I did see some sort of, at times, weaknesses in the backline as well. What did you think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's still there. Piqué, as much as I like him coming out of the back handling the ball, he's incredibly slow, and it's why he's still playing in Spain. And I mean, he's made overtures of going to the Premier League, to the EPL, but he's just a slow guy. And I mean, that shot, which by the way was a deflection, it deflected off
right.
And then went in, but they just seem a little flat in the back. And Puyol as well. The only guy that I really have completed out of the trust in his Captivia, who's the right fullback, I believe. And the other three guys, I'm just kind of like, I don't know. I mean, like, as soon as the second half started, there was a huge gap there. I mean, he had room to shoot that ball at the top of, you know, at the top of the 18, and he took it. And I've seen this sort of play from them, especially at the beginning of the game, at the beginning of a game, and then in the beginning of the second half, I've seen this play from them where they're just, it almost feels like they need to be jolted into waking up and getting their game together. And again, we saw it again today. I mean, we saw it in the last game against Honduras, and we definitely saw it against Switzerland. So, you know, like I'm saying, I'm hoping this is a slow build into the Portugal game.
Well, what can you tell us about the Iberian rivalry then? Portugal versus Spain, which is coming up in the second round.
They don't like each other. Portuguese and Spanish people don't like each other, and it's
that's so sweet.
It's contentious. So let's see what happens. I mean, Portugal sort of soundly beat Spain in the Euros 2004, I believe. Mm-hmm. They soundly beat them, and that was a team, a Spanish team that really just would fold under any sort of pressure. But this time around, I mean, even though Spain's not playing great, and even though you're seeing these defensive lapses and sort of them coming in and out of their game, they're a tough team with a lot of resolve, and I really think they're going to give Portugal's going to give them a hard time breaking them down, but Spain's also going to give Portugal a hard time with pressure that they're going to exert on them. So, you know, I think it's going to be a great game, actually.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to it.
And for what it's worth, Portugal is now stronger with Pepe back, so they have a fuller team.
Yeah, I mean, Portugal, they look tough. I can't say much for their attack, and I'm watching Ronaldo, like, just take idiotic shots from, like, 40 yards away. I mean, he did it all game this morning.
Pleasing to his teammates, like, it seemed.
Pleasing to the cameras, actually. That's what I think.
Yeah.
Well,
we'll see what happens.
Well, Tony, it's always good to talk to you here on the People's Game, and we'll catch up with you around the Portugal-Spain match.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is the People's Game, and now we are joined by Pablo Morales in our roundtable. And, Pablo, how you doing today?
I'm doing great. I'm full of anticipation for tomorrow's game.
Pablo's, of course, the filmmaker behind the film Gringos at the Gate. And again, the Gringos, I said, after their last match, had passed through the gate. They're in the castle. Well, right now they're back at the gate again because, once again, they have the biggest match they have to play in the history of U.S. men's soccer. It's against Ghana, and they have an opportunity to return to the quarterfinals for the second time in 3 years, but with much more of the nation in the world now paying attention to the U.S. men's team, impressed with them. And what do you make of the match tomorrow?
Oh, my God. I was at the match in 2006 with Ghana in the final game of the opening round, and I just remember how big and strong Ghana looked. Mm. And I haven't really I've watched the games, but I really don't know what to expect from Ghana. I think they have the ability to beat any team, much the same as the United States. I'm far, almost too nervous to even give it a rational evaluation. I'm hoping for a U.S. win.
Well, in 2006, remind listeners what happened, because it was a very tight group. The U.S. had been really beaten badly by Czechoslovakia in the opening match, and then they snapped back and tied Italy, who had previously defeated Ghana.
Yeah.
But while they were doing that, Ghana was upsetting the Czech Republic, who had come into the 2006 World Cup tournament ranked second in the world.
Yes,
Alan, can I just say, I'm astonished at the detail with which you remember the geometries of the 2006 World
Cup. Well, don't forget, both of my sides, right, Team USA, but primarily the Azzurri in 2006, were in the group, so I really remember the details of the group. Don't forget, Italy won the World Championship, and while, of course, they went to penalties against France, they were tied by one team, Team USA.
Yeah. And do you think, is this a grudge match or an accident of history that they're facing each other again in the World Cup?
It's an accident of history, absolutely. They'll be probably the only second time they've ever played against each other. You know, who expected the United States to come out first in their group?
Right.
You know, with England there, Ghana did a good job of getting out of their group, but they by no means were a truly dominant force. I mean, Germany lost to Serbia. That was a crazy group when you think about it, how it all ended up.
Well, USA, what had happened in that match is USA needed a win because they were at the bottom of the table with 1 point. And Clint Dembski scored a very impressive goal on a pass from DeMarcus Beasley to tie the game. And it ended in a good amount of controversy, which is a highlight I think many people will see in advance of the match tomorrow, where Gooch just basically is positioning himself to go straight up for a header, bumps into a player who's doing the same. And a penalty got called on it.
Right.
And
that's
how Ghana won. Now, Ghana USA
won on a dodgy call, yes.
Right. And that and the sort of paradox of the situation was is they actually would have gone through with a tie anyway because Czech Republic was at the time losing to Italy. The two teams meet up. I mean, the USA did go home, of course, fixated upon their defeat to Ghana. Ghana probably forgot about it after that and went on to the second round match.
I'm really looking forward to getting on to the next kind of phase of World Cup matches after today where it was such a grim match, the Portugal-Brazil match that should have been, by you know, in any other circumstance, that would have been a glorious match to watch. And instead, it was, you know, two teams competing not to lose. You know, they seemed to me it was a soul killing match personally,
right.
my point of view.
This was the least appealing day almost of the whole tournament.
Yeah, and that's over, right? I mean, when we get to the end of this round and go into the weekend, that part of the World Cup is over, and it's do or die. And I think we're just going to see a completely different level of game from both the U.S. and Ghana. I mean, I think the U.S. has worn its heart pretty much on its sleeve. However, there's going to be a sense of urgency behind this match that doesn't compare with what we've been seeing to date. So.
Yeah, Portugal against Brazil would have been a great first match of the World Cup versus the last match of the World Cup. You know, both teams are just filled with talented veterans who kind of realize that a tie would get them both through. And that's the worst possible situation for a final game.
Well, before USA plays Ghana tomorrow, just a quick word for maybe all of us about Uruguay, South Korea. And I just see Uruguay as too solid in the back, and just will definitely, in the course of 90 minutes of football, have a few moments of brilliance from Forlan. The question is between Forlan and some other potency up on their front line, I think South Korea is going to have to be alert at every moment of the game. And I would tip Uruguay as favorites in that match.
I agree with Alan, actually. Uruguay, I think, has a lot of talent in each line, actually. And they play this style that's played in the Southern Cone, like Argentina. They play a very, like, physical style. A lot of, you know, they use their body as, you know, one of the best defense. But also, I think Forlan and Suarez are just going to run over the Korean team. And I think Korea's going to have to, like, depend on their speed and just counterattacks.
Well, I mean, I can't say as I have a strong sense of what is going to happen. Mm. What I'm thinking that a lot of people underestimate Asian sides, that somehow that sort of The way that Orientalism works, where an Asian side is somehow persistently inscrutable, no matter how visible they are. I'm kind of almost hoping that they manage to kind of get through under cloak of the unknown. Not that South Korea is the most unknown side. I think Japan is a side that people are sort of even less familiar with. But I'm kind of hoping that Uruguay underestimates them. Because I think they're creative. They have a lot of ability and a lot of drive to win this game. I mean, of course, every team does, but I think the Asian sides have more riding on this than nearly almost anyone but the African teams. I mean, compared to Latin America, Europe, Asia, Africa, in terms of huge regions of the world that are grossly underrepresented in high-level international competition, and South Korea has a shot to, go further, and but I'm planning to watch it at Radio Korea Plaza, so I'm also wishing a good time for myself and all who will be keeping me company there.
Pablo, your thoughts on the match?
Well, my feeling is that the Korean team is a lot like the U.S. team back in the early 90s in that they rely a lot on their physicality and their ability to run. I think they're more talented technically than the U.S. teams of that period, but their strengths are that, and they showed this in the last two World Cups for sure and in the opening rounds, that you can't let up for 1 second. They are ready to go into that fifth gear at any moment, and they do have really talented players, probably not player for player as much as Uruguay, but when you have a team that works that hard together as a team, I don't see this as being a walk away by Uruguay. I think it'll be a very tight game, I think it's actually we'll really see what Uruguay has in this game for sure.
Well, how many goals has Uruguay conceded so far?
So far this tournament?
That's a zero, and they have a player who is a striker for Atletico Madrid, who is a marvelous striker, who they've pulled further back down the field, and he's proving to be just as marvelous, playing an even more central role in the team as both a attack force and a distributor. I think he's a great, great player, and he is at the absolute top of his career top of his game in what has already been an incredibly great career. I just think that extra spark that Forlan adds going into it, I think that will be what tips this match. But I could be completely wrong. South Korea definitely has some fast ability to, strike a team down, and they've shown it in this tournament. They got that goal against Argentina right before the half, opening that game back up. So, it'll be an exciting match, and I really envy Jennifer for being where she'll be. And we're going to hear later in the show from David Choi from Radio Korea describing in detail the scene in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I have an emotional attachment to the Reds just because of living in L.A. and having so many Korean friends. They're great, passionate fans.
Well, Pablo Morales, we will talk to you tomorrow after the USA-Ghana match and, of course, after the Uruguay-South Korea match. And so always great to have you here with us on the People's Game. This is the People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined right now by David Choi, who is the Chief Strategy Officer of Radio Korea here in Southern California. And for those people who don't know, Southern California is the metropolitan area in the world that has the largest community of Koreans outside of the Korean Peninsula. Tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. Los Angeles time, there will be a large screen television outside of Radio Korea's building on Wilshire Boulevard. There is a park, and it will be packed with people wearing red, rooting for South Korea, really one of the most incredible sights in America for a public screening of a televised World Cup match. David, tell the people a little bit about what will go on tomorrow at about 6 a.m., starting then and going forward.
Well, we're anticipating people to start showing up several hours before, as we've already had in the three matches. Anywhere from about 8,000 to 10,000 people are expected, just a sea of red, coming out to cheer South Korea versus Uruguay. They're in the second round of 16 now. And it's just an amazing scene. If you come out and see it, we've had every major news out there covering this event. And thus far, it's been very safe, no incidents, and all excitement. We've got two giant LED screens, live feed, coming in from the World Cup. And we're anticipating something huge tomorrow because the Korean team has never gone to the second round when they were playing out of Korea. So this is a eventful day for the Korean soccer, too.
In 2002, the response of the Korean fans in Korea rivals that of the sort of exuberance and enthusiasm for the team, certainly rivals any response I've ever seen from any partisan sports base of fans anywhere in the world. And I was in Los Angeles during the World Cup in 2002, and I did see a match in Koreatown, and it was unbelievable, and it really matched the energy, though one can't say for sure if it absolutely matched the energy of what was going on in Korea at the time, but it certainly approximated it. And so what will take place in Los Angeles is similar in this year as it was in 2002.
Well, I think every year it's been getting bigger. Radio Korea presented public viewing back in 2002 in Koreatown. And we also presented the same thing in 2006. And every year we've been getting more enthusiasm from not only the Koreans, but also just the Los Angeles community as well. But in Korea, I was just there a week ago for the June 17th match against Argentina. And it's something that I will never forget. 2 million people taking to the streets, very organized, giant screens everywhere. And it was just crazy. It's just amazing scene. Everybody cheering on for the team. And we're hoping to do that here. And I think we've done it, but in a much smaller scale. And LAPD seems to appreciate everyone's cooperation. So it's a very safe environment for the family. So everyone should, you know, plan on coming out.
Wilshire Boulevard is one of the great boulevards right through the heart of the city of Los Angeles. And right about in the middle between downtown, maybe a little closer to downtown than the Pacific Ocean, pretty much in the middle, is Western Boulevard, a perpendicular main intersection. And one block east of that, there is a city block that is a park, and that is where this crowd will gather with these two huge television screens and a sea of red. Now, Uruguay, it's not like they've drawn Argentina or Brazil or Spain. South Korea has to go into this match with a strong expectation of possibly moving on to the next round. Is that your sense?
You know, that is actually an expectation. You know, the big hurdle was getting into the round of 16. Now that they're in it, many sports commentators and whatnot in Korea are already looking at the quarterfinals. So, but hopefully they'll do well and move on to the next round.
And potentially their opponent in the quarterfinals might be USA, which of course plays in the later match tomorrow. And so will you be there tomorrow, David?
Absolutely. All of our Radio Korea employees will be there wearing our red and cheering our favorite team on and looking to have another phenomenal event.
Well, David Choi, a Chief Strategy Officer from Radio Korea based in Los Angeles, I want to thank you so much for joining us here on The People's Game.
Thank you so much. Good to be here.
This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined on the line by John James from the Ivory Coast. He posts on the website elephantsonline.com. He is a British and Ivorian national. And John, Ivory Coast, perhaps the team from the African continent that, if it could have gotten out of its group, maybe could have challenged for the title. A lot of people feel that way. They obviously got a very difficult draw. What's the feeling of people in the Ivory Coast? Are people very deflated, or do they think the team did honorably?
Yeah, I think in the end, most people were fairly happy with how the Elephants performed. It was a very difficult group, and this is only the second time Ivory Coast has been in the World Cup. And the first time was 4 years ago, and also in the group of death with that time Holland, Argentina, and Serbia. So, again, to be in the most difficult group was a really tough call. Well, to have that first draw against Portugal, that was seen as a victory almost here, the draw against the third-best team in the world. And then against Brazil, perhaps, it was disappointing to lose, but 3-1 and scoring for the first time an African team had scored against Brazil in the World Cup, that was something of an achievement. But not to lose, of course, never feels good, but at least it's better to lose against the best team in the world. And then today's result, well, the team scored three goals. It was a fairly decent performance. So they came out with 4 points, which is one better than last time. So people are delighted to be after the World Cup. They knew this was a good side with perhaps if it had an easier group, maybe just any of the other groups. Could have easily qualified and gone on to do some good things. But in the friendlies, they played against Paraguay and against Japan, being the better side in both of those friendlies recently, and both those two teams have qualified. So, yeah, a few regrets, but at the same time, I think no shame about how the team have performed.
Well, of course, once Portugal got the 3 points against North Korea, Portugal was going to play for a tie to assure that they would go through, and they pretty much did that today. I don't know if you saw that match. But to me, going into today's set of matches, it just seemed as if Ivory Coast were so unlucky, not only because of the draw, but also because Portugal got to play North Korea in a match where North Korea needed a result, and they broke out of their defensive shell, which had served North Korea so well against Brazil. And they got slaughtered once they broke out of it. And then they went into this match with Ivory Coast almost having no chance. So generally, though, people were happy with the way the team gelled and flowed. What I saw of today's match with North Korea, they played beautifully, I felt, Ivory Coast.
Yeah, I mean, you have to be aware of where Ivory Coast is coming from, which is a team of big names and, of course, no bigger than Didier Drogba, the captain and the striker, perhaps one of the best strikers in the world at the moment. But these stars have never really lived up to the hype, lived up to what they should be. And that was particularly felt at the African Nations Cup in January, where the team were the favourites, where people were expecting them to win, and they crashed out in the quarterfinals. After that, the coach was sacked, and then Sven-Göran Eriksson was appointed as the new coach, former coach of Mexico and England as well. So with that appointment, Sven had very little time, but he managed to make some little key changes in the team to get them playing together as a unit, moving forward and attacking and defending as one unit. And I think people were pleased to see the team working better together, not just a bunch of egos, each trying to individually shine, but actually the system functioning. So that pleased many people. And while some of the players might be retired in the next 3 years, there is hope that this team can do a bit more. And, next big tournament is in 2 years' time. So, we'll see. But people definitely saw improvements from what they were seeing in January.
What was it like when the Ivory Coast took the field for these games during the World Cup? How did the nation respond? Was the whole society stopped to watch the matches?
Yeah, I mean, people absolutely love their soccer here. I mean, it's just a huge thing for people. And, the whole city here came to a standstill. People, immediately before the game, there's traffic jams throughout the city. You really have to leave early to find your spot. And then people like being in social settings at in many of the bars. They're called Mackies here. Just simple affairs, wooden table, wooden chairs or plastic chairs, around a few beers and watching just on a small TV. But then other sites, a lot of the mobile phone companies have set up big areas and also some community groups, student groups that also set up sports halls with big video screens. And I tended to watch matches at those sorts of places, and with a big screen, a few thousand people behind. I mean, you can imagine the atmosphere was pretty wild. People love dancing, people love shouting and singing here, people doing all sorts of things. People have their vuvuzelas as well, which have been imported in and in craze here in Ivory Coast. And certainly orange all over the city with wigs and flags and the T-shirts, of course. So, people got very excited, perhaps less so for this match today than the Brazil match, but people really got in the spirit here, and people are like for the national team, which means so much to this country.
The team is full of stars from top clubs in Europe, but obviously Drogba is the star among stars for the Ivory Coast, and one of the really great global footballers of the past, say, half decade. What is his status in the Ivory Coast currently?
Didier Drogba is a huge figure here. He's the best player that Ivory Coast has ever had, the top goal scorer, and his role as a diplomat and an ambassador for Ivory Coast has been huge. Many people have only heard of Ivory Coast because of Didier Drogba, and also he's played a key role in helping to bring peace and unification to the country as well. You might not be aware, but Ivory Coast had a civil crisis, a rebellion in 2002, which split the country in two, and since that time the country has been divided between north and south. And when Didier Drogba won the African Football of the Year and did that for 2006, He brought the trophy back and took it behind rebel lines, the Blacke, which is the main rebel capital. And that was just greeted with hundreds of thousands of people in the streets. It was a huge event over there. And then he then brought a World Cup qualifying match to Blacke to be played in the stadium there, again behind rebel lines with rebel security. And those sorts of gestures just helped the country see that everyone followed the national football team, even that they were in different parts of the country, and that at the end of the day, everyone still thought of themselves as Ivoirians. So they helped to bring a sense of unity and something around which people could unite despite the difficulties in the country. You can see Didier Drogba's image around the city on the big billboards. He's advertising various things, but often, rather than that, promoting good causes, fighting against malaria, fighting for HIV/AIDS work and that sort of thing. So he's definitely a promoter of many good causes and, yeah, a key figure here in Ivory Coast. And obviously financially, I mean, he earns more than the president, so he's a big figure.
There's obviously tremendous talent on the Ivory Coast team, and the game is loved by the people in the Ivory Coast, and I imagine all the young boys play from the time they can start playing. But are there strong soccer institutions that young players develop at, or how is that working in the Ivory Coast now?
There's really one key institution that's been behind, I'd say about, from the top of my head, 80 to 90% of the players are actually in the World Cup squad at the moment. All came from one academy, and that's the ASEC Mimosa Academy, which was set up in 1993, and so that generation of players that are coming through now into the squad, and that was one of the first of these academies in the developing world, which provided a first-class education with boarding on site and with top European coaches as well to train the children. And so many people have come through that. It's recognised by FIFA as one of the best academies of its sort in the world, and now it's much copied. So that's really been the place that many people have come from. And so when you see Ivory Coast play, it's really ASEC Mimosa football that they're playing in. And many of those big stars, Didier Drogba aside, have come from ASEC. So that's a key, but now there's many copies around the world, but also particularly here in Ivory Coast, so there's slightly more diverse base. But in terms of quality and a first-class institution, even though we're here in very much a developing country, that sort of facility is available for people, and it's still producing stars that are making their way through the squad and probably will be for many years to come.
And Drogba himself actually spent his adolescence in France.
Drogba was a slightly different story. He was born here in Abidjan, but he went to France aged five, I think, and it's largely there, rather late in his life, comparatively speaking, that he started to pick up football. So there are a few players that came through from France, Ivoirians who were living over there, but most of the players learned their football here in Ivory Coast.
And lastly, Ghana is the only African side to go through to the second round in the first World Cup held on the continent of Africa. Do you think that the people of the Ivory Coast will throw their support behind Ghana in the next round? Obviously a question of particular relevance to people in the United States.
Yeah, no, there definitely will be. I mean, my Ivorian wife is getting ready to buy a Ghanaian flag, and people have been following the African teams very closely here, almost as their second team, whenever Cameroon play or Ghana or South Africa. People have been quite true to that sense of a continent-wide urge to see more African teams moving on further. And Ghana, of course, is right next door to Ivory Coast. The countries are very much sort of twins in terms of size and economies and importance. So, people will be following Ghana very closely. People have been very proud of Ghana's success at the junior level. With the lack of Ivory Coast in the second round, I think everyone will now be adopting Ghana here in Ivory Coast and probably throughout the continent.
Well, it's certainly something that the United States is familiar with, most distinctly recently from the Bush-Cheney years of the whole world rooting against the United States. But the national soccer team's not quite as nasty a group as the Bush-Cheney group, but I would expect nothing less for the first World Cup tournament in Africa. So I've been joined by John James on the phone from the Ivory Coast. His website is Elephants Online. And thank you so much, John, for joining us on the People's Game.
No problem. A pleasure.
Yeah, yeah, oh, oh. Yeah, la, la, yeah, yeah.
Welcome back to the People's Game. This is Jennifer Doyle of From a Left Wing, and I am on the phone with Jenna Pell, who is the voice behind AllWhiteKit.com, a fantastic and very reliable blog covering the WPS, the Women's Professional Soccer League in the U.S., but also the International Women's Game. And I thought I would take a break from the Men's World Cup to talk about that other game played by women in the U.S. The WPS season is actually in full swing. Unlike the MLS, the WPS has been playing through the World Cup. And then a lot of the national sides for European countries, the women's teams have been competing in qualifying matches for the Women's World Cup, which will be in Germany in 2007. So I thought this would be a good moment to get Jenna on the phone to give us a little bit of an update about how the WPS season has been unfolding. So, Jenna, who's looking really strong this season, and who's got an interesting story?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because now there's seven teams currently in WPS because the St. Louis franchise, the St. Louis Athletica, unfortunately folded about 6 weeks into the season. But it was quite a setback for the league, but it wasn't fatal, fortunately. What that meant was that there would be seven really, really strong competitive teams in WPS in the league. And right. That's what it is right now.
So they absorbed. Do the other teams absorb players from
the
Athletica?
Yes, that's exactly right.
Okay.
Right. So the players were just free agents. I mean, when the Soul folded in January, what happened was there was a dispersal draft because that was in January and that was before the season started.
Right.
But so the league was kind of scrambling to see what they could come up with, and so they just determined that free agency was the best route to go.
Yeah. The Los Angeles Soul, as she's speaking of, was the LA team that was playing in the same stadium as Chivas USA and the LA Galaxy, and so before the season started, the sort of depressing news came out that team had folded. So it's been kind of a rocky season for the WPS, losing the Soul, which had kind of marquee players like Marta, and the St. Louis Athletica. But Marta is now playing still in California. She's playing for Gold Pride, which plays in the Bay Area, and I think they've just moved to a new stadium, haven't they?
They did. They just moved to a new stadium. They moved to Hayward Stadium, which I believe is in Hayward, California. I'm just guessing there. But and fortunately, their latest game had the biggest attendance since their first opening game of the season. So that's good. So it seems like they're going to do quite well there.
Oh, that's
good.
You asked
who was the top of the league and who was the strongest team, and they are definitely the strongest team. And that's because their squad is just absolutely incredible. They have Marta. They play in a 4-3-3 formation, so they're very, very attack minded.
That's a little unusual in women's football, I think.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. They're the only team in WPS that actually plays in that formation. It's only because they have the players to actually do it.
Right.
So their front line is typically made up of Marta, Christine Sinclair, and Kelly O'Hara, who is a Stanford standout. So she's kind of like a local hero in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And then Shannon Box came to Gold Pride after the Athletica folded.
Wow.
But the thing that's really impressive about Gold Pride is that they're so they're very balanced. They're a very balanced team. You might think that they're way too attacking and they'd be themselves exposed to other attackers, but not at all. I mean, their defense is very, very strong, and they have a great goalkeeper, Nicole Barnhart.
Right.
So thus far, I think they've been first every week this season. We're going into the 11th week right now in WPS, and I think that they've been at the top of the league ever since.
And they're playing last year's season champions, the Sky Blue FC, who upset the Soul in the end of the season sort of knockout tournament. I was there for that game. That was actually really fun to watch. The Soul looked really cold. Many people who keep an eye on the women's game are aware of Marta. Who else should people be aware of who are playing in the WPS?
Well, there's a certain player who has a very, very interesting story, a very heartwarming story, really. And her name is Amy Rodriguez, and she was the overall draft pick last year. And last year was the first season for WPS.
And who does Amy Rodriguez play for?
And she plays for the Philadelphia Independents.
Uh-huh.
She's come off of a really tough season last year with the Boston Breakers. She was, like I said, she was drafted first overall at the Boston Breakers, but she only scored a very disappointing two goals, there was obviously some tension between her and the coach or her and the team or something. I mean, something just was not working there.
Yeah.
So they parted ways, and she ended up with the Philadelphia Independents. And since then, she's been just incredible. She's been on an incredible goal streak. She's already scored four goals, which is second most in the league. And she's really become the player that everybody hoped that she'd become.
Great.
So she's definitely a player to watch. She's only 23, I believe. So it's just great to see her have such a turnaround so quickly.
You know, I've always had this kind of bone to pick with the hoopla around Marta. I recognize that Marta is a gifted player, an incredible athlete. You know, she's got a lot of style as well. But sometimes it's as if she's the only great player out there when you look at the media coverage of the women's game. It's really a little bit depressing because somehow it's as if the media can only accommodate one gifted female soccer player at a time. And
there's like a quota. Yeah.
Yeah. And there are more out there. And then when you watch her play, I mean, what you see actually are people just marking the crap out of her. I'm watching her play for LA Soul was an exercise in watching her handle her own level of frustration. And then of course that creates opportunities for other players, as she draws defenders to herself. So it's been interesting for me with the WPS seeing this kind of, heralded superstar within women's soccer kind of fit into the actual kind of weekly grind of the WPS and finding her place in that. So Amy Rodriguez, and is there how about international players who are playing in the U.S.? Who should people be keeping their eye open there on that side?
There's a couple English players who have been really great so far in the WPS career. Excuse me. There's Eniola Oluko, and she's a 23-year-old Nigerian-born English player striker, and she's their typical number nine striker. She's big, she's strong, she's quick, she's great in the box. She's just a handful for defenders, and she was also one of those players that was with the Atletico last year, and she was their best player for sure. And she's actually gone to the Atlanta Beat, who are previously the worst team in WPS, or I should say the unluckiest, if I want to be kind. So she's gone to them and has kind of, I mean, she's only been there for two games, but so far she's definitely made her presence known in a sense. I mean, she's good at contributing and distributing passes and so on. So there's Eni Aluko, and then, there's also Kelly Smith, who, if you're even vaguely familiar with the women's game, you might be aware of. She plays with the Boston Breakers. And she's going to be a legend in the women's game pretty much. I mean, she's a fantastic player for Arsenal Ladies, which she played in England.
Yeah.
And sadly, her Boston team is kind of struggling a bit, but she's definitely the talisman in that squad.
Yeah, she is.
And then there's another player who is kind of broken out this season, who's kind of like one of my personal favorites, and her name's Karen Bardsley. And her story is interesting because she's actually California's best English goalkeeper in a sense, because she was actually born and raised in California. She went to Cal State Fullerton. But her parents are English, and she just grew up in an English household. So she has played for England her entire international career.
Wow.
And she has been fantastic for Sky Blue FC in goal. I mean, she has been the reason why Sky Blue FC are actually mid-table, not further down.
Right.
Because they're a very consistent team. But Karen Bardsley has been totally immense. And I really hope to see her as the number one goalkeeper for England in next year's World Cup.
And actually, that brings me to my next question, which is to ask you a little bit about the English women's national team, because I know you're a fan, and I know that I have long been frustrated with the way, just an awareness of the enormous amounts of resources which are poured into the men's national side, and then the incredible passion and talent that are English women's soccer players. And they've had just kind of a tough time in relationship to, for example, there was a petition to get a Great Britain side into the Olympics, which would have been really important for women players in England because it opens up lottery money, which supports the development of athletes. But the men's national football associations within the Great Britain, which is Wales, Scotland, England, Northern Ireland, refused to allow that to happen for the women. Which is kind of a very bureaucratic and technical thing in which the interests of national men's football associations have actively suppressed the development of the women's game. So tell me a little bit about, like, what's the women's team like this year and why you're so excited about them.
Well, initially I think I was captivated by the England women's national team back in last year in the Euro and the European Championships, the 2009 European Championship. And this was a team that's never... I mean, they haven't been fantastic on the international stage. I mean, they've never won a major tournament. They've never even been to a final of a major tournament.
Right.
And I just, like, haphazardly stumbled upon, like, the semifinal between England and the Dutch. And England their chips were definitely down in the match. And the Dutch pushed them all the way to extra time. And I, for sure, thought that they would be going to penalties. And England aren't traditionally very good at penalties, kind of like on the men's side. And so I thought that, that this team wasn't going to make it. But a 22-year-old player named Jill Scott scored, like, this amazing goal with, like, 2 minutes left, and they, like, romped their way to the final.
Yeah.
And sadly, they lost 6-2 to the final. They got vanquished, but it was one hell of a journey to get there. And yeah, after that, I was just like, this team has so much heart. I mean, I'm really quite interested in this team. And so,
They lost to Germany, who are kind of superstars in the international women's game. And I should say, there's a 10-part documentary on YouTube. The besten Frauen in die Welt, and the best women in the world, and basically they look like NASA astronauts in training. It's some of the most technologically advanced cross-training techniques. It's really jaw-dropping, and you can be sure that those English women players aren't being offered that kind of level of technical support.
So, I mean, the stereotype about German athletes, but the German football is that it's very efficient, and that is the same for the women's team.
Yeah.
That's why, I mean, I should also mention that the women's team has won 5 out of the 6 previous European championships that there ever has been. So, I mean, they're completely dominant in terms of Europe. So here comes this, like, plucky little team, and they did so well to get to the final. But there's something that made me, that inspired me to write a recent article I had up on the blog about, it was the day England's goalless draw to Algeria, where they basically, the men's team obviously, where they basically showed no heart, no inspiration, nothing. I mean, it was just a disaster. And England women had a game the next day, and it was the World Cup, a World Cup qualifier against Spain.
Wow.
And Spain were tied and points in World Cup qualifying. And basically, if Spain won the game by 2 goals, they'd qualify, thereby eliminating England from World Cup contention this year, which would have been a
disaster
for England. So what happened was Spain got 2 early goals.
Mm.
And so it was heading into about the 80th minute, and Spain was still up 2-0, and it wasn't looking very good. It was looking kind of dim for England. But They managed to get two goals within like 10 minutes.
Wow!
And the equalizing goal was by their captain named Faye White.
Oh my gosh!
Central defender, a 32-year-old central defender. So this would be her last World Cup campaign ever. So so they managed to just roar back and score 2 late goals.
Ugh.
And now I mean, they're not eliminated, and now they have to just win 1 out of their 2 games in the next month, I believe, and they'll qualify.
Wow.
So, yeah, and so, I mean, I was just, like, totally inspired by, like, by their performance, their comeback performance, and all the fight and the spirit and the heart they showed. And I was just really
Jenna, where are you watching this? Because, I mean, watching women's football, and never mind international women's football, that's an achievement. So can you tell listeners how on earth did you manage to watch this game?
Sadly, I couldn't watch it. I had to follow it on the FA website, the Football Association website. They had a pretty good match tracker.
Right.
So the game was played in Spain, and so typically when games aren't played in like Europe or Germany or England or Germany, they're not televised.
Right.
There's no streams on the internet available.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you just have to follow it on match tracker or something or on a match or goofy match tracker if you can find it.
Right.
Or something else. I mean, but it's just so hard to come by. It's really really difficult to follow the game. I mean, it makes it really. I mean, hopefully that can change soon. But
I hope so too. So for our last subject, I just wanted to ask you about the upcoming WPS All-Star Game. So I hear that you're actually going to go.
Yes,
and
I'm excited about that.
Where is that?
It's in Atlanta. The Atlanta Beat franchise is in WPS, and they're one of the 2 expansion teams this year. And they just opened a beautiful new stadium with a 7,500 capacity, and it's actually the only stadium in the United States that's built specifically for women's soccer.
Oh, wow.
So it's not... Yeah, so it's not shared with the men's soccer team. It's built specifically for the team, for the Atlanta Beat, and it's absolutely beautiful. I mean, it's just a gorgeous facility.
Oh, that's
so
great.
So yeah, the All-Star Game will be played there, and the format of it is actually pretty cool. If you want to hear about it,
yeah, very quickly.
Yeah, well, so the fans, the media, and the players and the coaches got to vote on the 22 players that they'd like to see in the All-Star Game. And so what would happen is the 2 highest vote getters would actually be named, or the highest American vote getter and the highest international vote getter would be named team captains.
Mm.
And they would actually pick the 11 players they'd want in their squads. And then the 2 squads would face off in the All-Star games. Like last year they played, the WPS All-Stars played, Umea EK, which is a Swedish team, so an international team. But now this year they're actually playing each other, so it really will be the best in the league against each other.
Oh, that's great.
And Abby Wambach and Marta got selected, so on Monday next week they'll pick their teams, practice Tuesday, and then play Wednesday.
Oh,
so
fantastic.
It's very, very exciting. Yes.
Great. Well, I want to thank you for taking the time to give us the lowdown on the women's game. This is Jenna Pell. She is the woman behind All White Kit. It's allwhitekit.com, a fantastic blog focusing on the women's game both at home and abroad. And this is Jennifer Doyle with The People's Game, and thank you for listening. Thanks, Jenna.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And so, in today's roundtable, as I speak to my beautiful darling daughter Millie here, we came up with a plan for global football revolution. Here's the idea, as it were, so to speak, hatched.
Better now.
Yeah.
the loss of the 4:30 games really helped.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, I thought I was going to come apart after the last U.S. game, I'm doing good. How are you guys holding up?
Okay.
My job is extra demanding and stressful, and that's sort of destroying me at this point.
That's been fun to watch.
I can't wait to get to, what is it, Wednesday?
Where there's no games.
Yeah, I've thoroughly enjoyed being on vacation for the last week, I can tell you that.
Well, we're going to propose, actually, as a political movement, that by 4 years from now, it's an international holiday.
The first week.
That's wonderful. That sounds great. Right. Everybody will be able to agree on that one.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see who the real enemies are.
Except for Glenn Beck.
I may include that in today's show. So there you have it, folks, a call for global revolution. I figure we have about 3 years to build this movement before it has to go into the final phase to ensure implementation. And we'll see who's really with us and who's against us. 2 weeks, complete shutdown except for essential services, the first 2 weeks of the World Cup. We can call it the June 25th movement. Today's June 25th, 2 weeks after the beginning of the World Cup soccer tournament 2010 in South Africa. I'm Alan Minsky. I want to thank my producer, Fernando Romero, Jennifer, Nick, Tony, Pablo, and all of our guests from today's show. This is The People's Game.